Good evening, everyone. Erev Tov. Welcome to Beit Emanuel Torah Tuesday. This is the week of Parashat Teruma. We'll talk a little bit about what Teruma means later in the course. Most quick summaries would tell you it just is the name for one of the heave offerings or one of the offerings in the tabernacle, and that would be correct. But we're also going to look at what the letters of the words actually mean together. Outside, if there was never a sacrificial system, what would teruma mean? So we're going to talk about, it kind of has a double meaning. So that'll come up later. It's the 19th portion of the Torah. It's in the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, chapter 25, verse 1. And it goes through chapter 27, verse 19. So chapter 25 through 27, 19 make up this, the 19th portion of the Torah. And I'm thinking about it. Next week there will be no Torah class, so I need to make sure I remind you of that. And I also tried to send out an email about that as well, that next week there will be no Torah class. I'll be presenting at a conference, so no class next week. But let's get started with the blessing before the study of Torah. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav v'ciuvanu le'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments, has commanded us to be immersed into the words and the matters of Torah. Amen. All right, so our nugget for today from Rabbi Avraham Twersky, from Living Each Day. I think you may enjoy this one, because when you think to the book of Genesis and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, maybe you've never pondered this before, but maybe you have pondered it. Was it true that before the eating of the fruit, Adam and Eve had no idea how to discern what evil was? Did they not know what evil was before it? So was that really fair to them? What was the actual eating? So maybe you've pondered that. And so Twersky is going to quote a fantastic sage, the Maharal of Prague. Some of his stuff is becoming available in English, but the Maharal, fascinating commentator on this Torah. So let's just kind of dig into this, and I'll just kind of read Twersky and the Maharal, and then let it soak in for you. Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 through 17. There the Torah says, of all the fruits of the trees of the garden, you may eat. But of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat. How is it, asked the Maharal of Prague, that man acquired the valuable capacity to discern between good and evil as a result of transgressing the commandment of God? That kind of doesn't sound right. The Maharal goes on to explain that prior to disobeying God, man could avoid wrong, not because he intellectually knew it to be wrong, but because he would instinctively be repelled by wrong, just as animals instinctively avoid eating poisonous plants. You may see certain animals, they just seem to know by instinct, right? They haven't gone to science class, and their mom didn't teach them to stay away from, didn't have to teach them to stay away from the lions of the jungle and things like that. They instinctively, intuitively seem to know what to eat, what not to eat, where to go, where not to go. And the Maharal says this is the way it was for Adam and Eve, that it was just intuitive in them because they were totally pure. They were repelled by anything that wasn't totally pure. Operating by instinct is far more efficient than having to stop and analyze things intellectually. Man did not gain anything by disobeying God. See, it often can sound like in the Torah, they gained something positive by disobedience. But the Maharal says, man gained nothing by disobeying God. Rather, man lost a precious capacity that we no longer now intuitively know what evil is. Sometimes we think that we may gain something by transgressing a divine commandment, but this too is a delusion. What appears to be a gain is actually a loss, for God cannot be outsmarted. All right, so something there for you to chew on about the garden for you. And love your neighbor, again, following Yeshua's commandment that our teaching that the two most important things for us to know is to love the Lord our God and to love our neighbor as ourself, and that everything else and all of the Torah, all of the scriptures hang on those two principles. So we've been looking each week at a couple of things, this week mainly just one item about how to love our neighbor and how that's expressed in the given week's portion. So, Exodus chapter 25, verse 11. It says, you shall overlay it, that is the ark, with pure gold. Inside and out you shall overlay it with gold, and you shall make on it a molding of gold around it. Now, the Kiskuni is a 13th century commentator of the Torah. I don't know of anything he has written is in English, but the Kiskuni wrote that the Aron, and the Aron is the ark where the original 10 words were placed, it consisted of a wooden layer sandwiched between two golden layers. Right, that's how it was told to be constructed, that it would be wooden structure, but that it would have gold all around it. He says, if you look at how everything else is constructed in the tabernacle, it really should have been solid gold. Because if you read this week's portion about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, so much stuff is solid. All right, but this is not solid. And so the Kiskuni says, the reason for this was that it had to be carried on the shoulders of the Levites and the children of Israel as they journeyed through the desert. Because the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is the mash unit, right? It's the take apart, carry with you as you travel through the wilderness. And so it had to be carried on the shoulders of the Levites and the children of Israel as they did this. If the ark would have been made entirely out of gold, it would have been, what do you think? Pretty heavy, right? And so it would have been very difficult for the people who were responsible for carrying it, because, if you've read the portion, bad things tend to happen to people who drop these kind of holy items, right? And so by just making it gold-covered instead of solid gold, it lightens the load. Well, the Kiskuni has a nice rabbinic argument here. If the holy ark was made lighter than it might have been in order to lighten the burden of fellow Levites who had to carry it, how much more so should we learn from this to always try to alleviate the burden of our neighbor? And so Shaul in Galatians 6 verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the Torah of Messiah. So we love our neighbor when we try to lighten their burdens, just as God lightened the burden of the Levites who had to carry the ark on their shoulders. Right? So the Kiskuni made an inference that if God lightened the load for them, how much more so should we try to lighten the load for one another? So a summary a little bit of this week's portion, Exodus 25 through 27:19. It's primarily about, or the beginning of the discussion, because it goes on for a while in Exodus, of the construction of the Mishkan, that is the tabernacle in the wilderness, which is the prototype for the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. But it's also, as we're going to see, and as we've talked about in previous years, a map, a model, a microcosm, a fractal, whatever word you like best, of a lot of different things, all right, including our own bodies, the universe, our soul, and so forth and so on. So the portion starts out that the people of Israel are called to contribute 13 materials. Not 12, not 14. 13 materials. Gold, silver, and copper. Techelet. Red dyed wool, flax, goat hair, animal skins, including one interesting animal we'll talk about later, wood, olive oil, spices, and gems. Now, review for veteran Torah students. What should 13 immediately make you think of when you hear to collect 13 materials? Adonai, Adonai, Arachum Ekanu. The 13 attributes of mercy. Alright, when Moses wants to see Hashem, and God says, you can't bear it, but I will let you see my train. And then what he actually sees, what the book of Exodus gives us, is these 13 attributes, right? And these 13 attributes actually infuse all of creation. Okay? So these 13 materials are gonna have a connection to the 13 attributes that should make up our temple, our tabernacle. But they're to collect these, and God says to Moses, they shall make for me a sanctuary, a mishkan, right? A holy place, a set apart place, a sanctified place, and I will dwell among in them, not it. That's important grammar. Collect all these things, make for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell in them, not it. Okay, and we're going to talk about that later. On the summit of Sinai, Moses is given these detailed instructions on how to construct this dwelling for God so that it could be readily dismantled, transported, and then reassembled as the people journey through the desert on their soul perfection, right? Getting this process of getting all of the Egypt out of them so that they would then be ready to cross over and enter into the promised land, which is their salvation. In the tabernacle's inner chamber, behind an artistically woven curtain, was the ark that contained the original tablets of testimony, which had the 10 words engraved on it. The ark's cover had two winged cherubim hammered out of pure gold. We'll talk about those cherubim a little bit later. That even though they're two cherubim, the Torah is implicit that it's one piece. So what appears to be two is in fact one. It's another major theme of the Torah that I'm just now starting to reveal to you guys, okay? That what appears to be two, what appears to be duality, what appears to be opposite, what appears to be opposed, is actually one. Right? It is a fundamental aspect of the Torah. Right? And this is the same with the cherubim. It looks like two, but the Torah is emphatic that it be constructed of one consistent piece of gold. In the outer chamber stood the seven-branch menorah, which also had to be constructed how? One piece. You couldn't take a mold and fuse two sides together. Even now at the Temple Institute, where they're trying to recreate all these vessels, I think you can even go on their website, they struggled for decades upon decades to figure out how to make a menorah of just one piece. Right? Where you couldn't... It almost seemed like an impossible task to construct it the way the Torah does. All right? Which is significant. And then there was the table upon which the showbread was arranged. The tabernacle's three walls were fitted together from 48 upright wooden boards, each of which was overlaid with gold and held up by a pair of silver foundation sockets. The roof was formed of three layers of coverings, tapestries of multicolored wool and linen, a covering made of goat hair, and a covering made of ram, and what in the Hebrew is called the takish. All right? The takish. I don't even know. I've failed to look up how different English translations translate takish. But do you want to know how the rabbis have always interpreted takish? A unicorn. If you ever wonder where the mythological creature unicorn, the unicorn came from, it is actually in your Torah, the Takish. Okay? And why aren't there unicorns now? Because they only were needed to furnish their skin for the tabernacle. When the tabernacle ceased, they ceased. All right? But the Takish. Okay? Across the front of the sanctuary was an embroidered screen held up by 5 posts. It's unfortunate. That's where, unfortunately, our English translators let their bias get in their way. Because what do they say when they look up in a Hebrew dictionary that Takish means unicorn? What do they say? Unicorns don't exist. Well, guess what? A lot of animals don't exist anymore that once existed. Why is that so hard to believe that an animal is now extinct that existed 3,000 years ago? Did we not believe there was a dodo bird? Right? Woolly mammoth. There's no woolly mammoths now. There never has been woolly mammoths. Right? So, it's a little bit of a bias. The Takish show unicorn skin. And what was neat about the unicorn, when the rabbis comment on it, is that it was multicolored. Which, if you ever see little fairy tales about unicorns, what is always associated with them? Rainbows. Right? Now you know the Torah tradition behind that. Okay? Surrounding the sanctuary and the copper-plated altar, which fronted it, was an enclosure of linen hangings supported by 60 wooden posts with silver hooks and trimmings and reinforced by copper stakes. Copper is a significant metal. We're not going to talk about copper this evening. We've done it in the past, and it could merit another full discussion, but we will maybe do that next year. All right, so that's kind of the summary of the parashat. Okay, it's all about getting this Mishkan, this holy place, this sanctuary built. And it's very precise, very precision instructions. It's not like find what you can, use whatever materials you find. It's the best of the best. It's gold, it's bronze, it's copper. It's specific. It's got blueprints with very tight measurements. And we'll see if you paid attention to those measurements because, again, try your best to divorce. In fact, you know, I've been trying to rethink how to do like what we do in our congregation, what's called confirmation, teaching youth, all right, the basics of their faith. Because the way we do it is the way they did it in the Middle Ages. But the problem with that is not that they did it wrong in the Middle Ages, but today's 12-year-old is far more literate than a middle age, 12-year-old in the Middle Ages. 12-year-old in the Middle Ages was probably already working the farm, had long since stopped trying to read, if they ever did try to read. Today's 12-year-old is far more comfortable with abstract concepts. Think about all the things they've been exposed to already by the age of 12, all the information that's come to them. It's just a different world. So maybe the teaching model of a middle-aged schoolroom isn't the teaching model in your schoolroom today, shouldn't be in your schoolroom today. All right? And so, when we look at this, kind of keep that perspective in mind. All right? That, the shift there, okay? And just kind of keep that floating with you, okay? Take for me an offering. Okay? So, we're going to look at the vocabulary here. Exodus chapter 25, verse 2. In preparation for building the tabernacle, God commanded Moses to collect the necessary materials. He says in Exodus 25, verse 2, speak to the Israelites and have them take for me an offering. Does anyone's text not say take? Good. Raise, all right. It says take. Okay, the reason they want to try to change that on you is what we're going to talk about. It doesn't sound right to say take. All right. Speak to the Israelites and have them take for me an offering. From every person whose heart inspires him to donate, you shall take my offering. Okay. So why does God command Moses to take the donations? Wouldn't the verse read better and, not to say, nicer if they were to give an offering? After all, they are to donate as their heart inspires. They're not to be compelled, right? They're not to be given to pledge cards, nothing. It's as they feel fit, no judgment given, right? So take is kind of the wrong verb for that. It should be let them come and give what's on their heart. But instead it says take it. Okay? So why is it take instead of give? Okay? The language of taking can lead one to conclude that the materials could have been taken from the people by force. But this was not the case, because the Torah does stress the offerings were to be donated freely from every person whose heart inspires him or her to donate. So first, let's discuss why the offering had to be voluntary. All right, instead of saying everyone give 10% or everyone give 3% or everyone give their first born cow, why did it have to be voluntary? And then we'll move on to why it had to be taken instead of given. The Talmud in Baba Batra 8b teaches that a community can force members of the community to support the poor and needy. Using our money to help others is a trait that needs to be trained and developed early on. So the Talmud ruled it was permissible to force charity so that the young in the community would know that this was to be the norm and it was what was to be expected of them as members of the community. So why did God command that these gifts for the tabernacle, the very first act of charity on the national level, be donated solely out of sincere generosity? Well, the mitzvah of tzedakah, of charity, is meant to accomplish two primary objectives, or two primary connections, or two primary refinements. Let me give you another face of the word mitzvot. Connection and refinement. It's a refinement as well. That is, by doing this mitzvah, this connection, you're not only making a connection with God, but you are also refining a certain aspect of your soul that cannot be refined any other way except through this portal. Right? So each mitzvah is not only a unique connection, as we've talked about for several years now, now you're getting another layer. It's also a refinement of your soul, of a blemish in you. All right? It's a refinement. Tzedakah, charity, addresses two of these. The first concerns the person receiving the charity. Through this mitzvah, the poor are provided with what they lack. The second objective concerns the one who is giving the charity. By donating our time and our money, we express and exercise our inner qualities of chesed and kindness in a concrete and tangible manner. The act of tzedakah, charity, actualizes our trait of generosity, and it contributes towards our own spiritual growth. That is, what charity does for the giver is that it moves the potential chesed energy within you, and it becomes actual kinetic chesed energy. So it moves something that's dormant within you into something that now is active in you, right? It awakens it within you. And that not only benefits you, but it benefits the whole world. Okay, so the chesed that's within all of us, chesed is one of the 13 attributes, by the way. It's one of the 13 items that make up your temple, your tabernacle, that's you, all right? It's there, but it's just lying there. Charity is what moves it from potential to actual. Now, we can distinguish between these two objectives within the act itself. The first goal stresses the aspect of giving to the needy. The important factor here is that the poor person receives the assistance he needs. The second goal, on the other hand, stresses the aspect of taking from the benefactor. This is a special benefit of the mitzvah of tzedakah, of charity. By relinquishing our material possessions for the sake of others, we are refining our own character traits and thereby elevating our soul, maturing our own being. Which of these two goals is the principal objective of tzedakah? Well, the sages in the Talmud in Shabbat 104a noted that in the Hebrew letter Gimel, which I have on your sheet, Gimel appears to be facing the next letter in the alphabet, the Dalet, which with its left leg stretched out toward the Dalet. All right? Looks like you ever done that with your fingers, like I'm running, right? That's what a Gimel looks like. It looks like a running little leg, okay? It's hieroglyphics. Remember, Hebrew is hieroglyphic, okay? Why is the Gimel running toward the Dalet? Shabbat 104 says that the Gimel is the benefactor. It's the one giving charity. It comes from coming from the word gomel, which means the one who gives or the one who supports. The Gimel is chasing, running after the impoverished Dalet, from the word dal, meaning poor or needy, in order to help him. Why is the benefactor running after the poor? Wouldn't you think it would be the other way around? Well, the sages wanted to teach us that the principal aim of Zedekah is connected to the very foundation of the universe. The true goal of charity is to elevate the soul of the giver. Right? And that is why in the exchange, the one who is receiving, the poor one, is actually doing a greater service than the one who is giving. Because it's giving the giver the opportunity to elevate his soul. Charity is more about the giver than the receiver. After all, if the purpose was simply to help the poor, God could have provided other means for their support without having to simply rely on the generosity of society. But as we probably all know, to varying degrees, being generous, truly generous, is very hard, right? It's very hard. And so you can begin to see how it does shape your character, or it will prohibit the development of your character, right, if you're stingy. The shapes of the Hebrew letters, again, the letters which God used to create the universe, hint at this fundamental truth. The Gimels, the benefactors, need to pursue the Dalets, the poor, in order for them to grow and develop spiritually and to activate the chesed that is within them. Thus, the Hebrew people's very first philanthropic project emphasized the central aspect of charity is not giving to the needy, but that it is taking from the donor. Have them take for me, is what it says, an offering. So God commanded that the contributions to the tabernacle be given freely, everyone whose heart inspires him to donate, since the soul and its traits are only refined when one donates willingly. I shall dwell within them. So the purpose of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, is stated in this week's parasha. Exodus 25, verse 8. They shall build for me a holy place, and I shall dwell in with them. Many of the commentaries note that the verse does not state that God will dwell within it, the Mishkan. He doesn't promise that he's going to dwell in the tabernacle. Right? It's probably what we think he said. But he does not promise he's going to dwell in the tabernacle. He says, build the tabernacle and I will dwell in them, the people. Okay? Within the heart and the soul of each person. That's the promise. All right. Not build the tabernacle so I can live in the tabernacle. Build the tabernacle so that I can then live in the people. So the tabernacle just becomes the vehicle, the means to bring heaven down to earth so that then heaven can enter into the people. All right. It isn't just to be there in the building. Therefore, even after the physical structure of the tabernacle leaves and is replaced by the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, even after the temple was destroyed, the Shekinah, God's presence, was able to continue to dwell among God's people. Right? Because he wasn't in the building. That was one of the big boo-boos of Yeshua's generation. They got wrapped up into thinking it was in the building instead of remembering it was in them. Right? So even after the buildings are destroyed, he's already entered into his people. And so the Shekinah can still dwell among God's people. The eternal Mikdash, that exists in the heart of every follower of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so this is the Torah basis of where Shaul can say, do you not know that your body is a mishkan, a tabernacle, a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19. Shaul has a Torah-based reason for saying that. It's Exodus 25, 8. Build the tabernacle so that then a portal will be opened and I can go into the portal, enter into my people through the tabernacle. Well, that's occurred. And so, now, the Shekinah, the presence of God, exists in the hearts and minds of His people. And so, Shaul tells us, we are a temple. We are a tabernacle. We are a dwelling place. The Tukine Zohar, not available in English, says, when the Shekinah is in exile, the verse states of it, quoting Genesis, the dove found no place on which to rest. So it's saying the dove in the flood story was God's represented God's presence, and it was trying to find a place to dwell. Blessed is he who prepares for this dove a pleasant dwelling in his heart. Therefore, it was so important that the donations for the Mishkan, the tabernacle, came from the uplifted hearts of the people. Since the point of the tabernacle was not just its physical structure, but the opportunity it created for the Shekinah to rest in the hearts of the actual people themselves. So think of it in terms of technology now. This is what I was going back to about students learning differently. Okay? Strip everything you know from technology and science and all of that, because, again, a high school student today knows far more science than probably the physician of a town in, you know, the 1700s, okay? They didn't even know what germs were back then, okay? They didn't know you were supposed to wash your hands, okay? So, you have to ask, what are they trying to describe in a language that's 3,500 years ago? What do you see being described in this building of the tabernacle with its precise instructions? You see essentially the building of a microchip, right? You're building a microchip so that when you plug that thing in, circuits and all that start firing, and boom, you got powerful connection. So they're building circuits for Hashem to come into this world. All right? And this gets to be more powerful when you start thinking incarnation of our Messiah. John 1:14, the Word became flesh and tabernacled is the literal word among us, right? He becomes this tabernacle, which means he becomes this circuit of infusing divinity and the divine into this physical world. So that's what's being described here, okay? Is they're building the circuit board that will allow heaven to enter into this world, but not so that it just stays in the circuit, like, when you put a circuit into a computer, or when you put the Intel chip into your computer, it's not just so you can look at the Intel chip, right? It's so that it will do, right? So that it will benefit. They're building the tabernacle not so that God just circles around in there, but so that it can come into them and live within them, right? This is how that is going to get here, right? It's going to bring the two. Heaven and earth are going to kiss through this circuitry. Okay? So, because when you think about it, God has no need for silver or gold. Right? But when you make chips and circuits and all that, right, you use different metals, you use different kinds of things to do different kinds of conductions. All of that's being hinted at with the different materials, the different colors. All of this is describing circuitry. Just like, as we'll see, all of the Aron, the place of the Ark, the cherubim, all of that, it's, how would you describe dimensionality to an ancient nomadic people who didn't write or read, just orally? How would you, around the campfire, describe dimensionality? Right? Well, we're going to see the Torah does. All right? The Torah does that in this portion. Right? So that's what I'm saying when you're reading this. You have to remember, I'm not, when I teach my 12-year-old, I'm not teaching the 12-year-old peasant girl in Germany from 1527. I'm teaching the 21st century 12-year-old who has the world at her thumb, literally, right? And so having her memorize 12 questions with archaic answers, not going to compute, right? Not going to compute. So we're trying to reconstruct what technology, it's spiritual technology that this whole tabernacle section's about. It's about spiritual technology. That's exactly what it's describing. All right? And so we're going to try to decode with where our knowledge has taken us so that we, with our current maps and models and metaphors, with understanding holograms and dimensions and fractals and projections and all of that, we can now get a better grasp on what Moses was trying to teach and exactly how awesome Moses really was. Okay? So God has no need for silver or gold. Rather, what he needs and wants and desires is for the children of Israel and for his people to show that they have a desire for him to dwell among them. Remember, he wants a relationship. And even though he's God Almighty and everything you think about God, he wants relationship. Well, you can't have relationship if you force the other person in a relationship. That would be rape. When you force someone to love you because you love them and you force someone to do something because of that, that's not freedom and it's not reciprocal. And so it's no one would call that a relationship. And so God has to give the freedom if he wants genuine relationship, genuine love. He has to allow the other side to have the freedom to desire him. But it's a big risk God takes when he does that. Because when you give someone total freedom to reciprocate the love you've given to them, the great risk is what? That they will not reciprocate it back to you, that they will just take what your love gave them and run and go somewhere else and give that love away. But God saw you as one who is worth the risk. It's a great risk that God takes by giving us that freedom. A huge risk. But it's the only way we can be in real relationship with him. And so he wants this offering to be free, not forced, not coerced, not suggested donation at the door, nothing like that, because he wants them to say, we want you here. The whole, that's part of the technology of the system is that they have to put some input into it. They have to build it, right? It's all by God's initiative. It's all God's sovereignty. God's in control of it. But after he gives it to them, he then backs off and says, you have to invite me. You have to input the command to please enter, right? And so that's what he wants from them. Okay, he wants them to want him. And he wants to see that they're willing to sacrifice in order to get that. Thereby, he would see that his love is reciprocated. And that just as he desires to dwell among us, so too his people desire his presence. And this is really no different from a mortal, average Joe guest. You feel most comfortable in a place where you know you're wanted. Right? You were invited over. You know you were invited over. They wanted you over. They made your favorite meal or they had your favorite dessert. And that's where you're going to feel comfortable. You're going to feel most comfortable when you have been invited to a place where you know you're wanted. You're happy when your hosts seem eager that you're there and glad you're there. But if you were to sense that the host really didn't want you there and would rather not have you there, it's very uncomfortable, right? And can be unpleasant. Same is true of God's desire to dwell among us. Midrash puts it this way. When Hashem created the world, he desired a dwelling place in the lower world, just as he had in the world above. And so when he created man, he said, this is what I desire, to have a dwelling place below as above. And so the donations for the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, had to be given from uplifted hearts, out of generosity, out of free will, out of sincere desire, to demonstrate the joy to have God dwell among them. Only after the people opened their hearts could God's presence enter to dwell within them, not it. Okay? So the point of building the tabernacle, the point of building the temple, was not so God would dwell in it, but that it was the chip, the technology that would allow the energy and the force and the creator of the universe, the infinite, to dwell in the finite heart and mind of a person. Right? That's the technology. Above the top, we're going to keep talking about this technology. Exodus 25, verse 10. I shall speak with you from atop the cover, from between the two cherubim, that are on the ark. So the tabernacle, the Mishkan, served the people for over 400 years. And then it was replaced by the first temple, which Shlomo, Solomon, built. But that was destroyed. Then came the second temple that was rebuilt by Ezra and Nehemiah. That too was destroyed. And soon, Ezra to Shem, there will come the third and final temple built by the Messiah himself, never to be destroyed. But God told Moses and the people that it would be from within this place that he would speak with the people. But are we to believe that since the tabernacle and the temples are gone, that we have no place to go in order to hear God speak to us? God forbid that be the case, right? So that clearly can't be what the Torah is teaching. Can't be that he spoke from there, and therefore he only spoke from there, hence he hasn't spoken for 2,000 years. Now remember, as we've emphasized in the Torah Sparks series, the Torah is more than just a mere history book. Does it contain history? Yes. It's more than a mere history book. In fact, although it is historically correct and accurate and all the good stuff you want to say about it, that's actually not the most important part about it. And so if that's your focus, you're just missing the whole deal. All right? Moses was not setting out to disprove the science guy about creation. That was not Moses' intent. Moses had a much more elevated reason for writing and conveying the truths of the Torah. Is it a history book? Yes. It's more than a history book. So, in fact, its main purpose is beyond history. It's supra-historical. It's beyond, above history. It is what gives history its reality. All right? It gives it its structure. So it's more than a history book. Thus, somehow and in some way, the tabernacle and its predecessors, that the ones that come after the temple, had to be physical enactments of our individual spiritual lives. All right, so the tabernacle is a physical enactment of our individual spiritual lives. It is laying out onto the table, just like if you were building a house and you had the detailed blueprints where it had where the wires were going to go, where the steps were going to be built, what types of materials are going to be used, all that super, super detailed blueprint. That's the Mishkan, that's the tabernacle of your soul. It's laying it out on there, right? But remember, they didn't have terminology like circuits and you know, chips and things like that. 3,500 years ago, 5,000 years ago, they had a different way of explaining these things. So we're trying to use our maps, our models, our metaphors to understand the deeper spiritual truths that Moses was conveying. So even today, there must be some place where we can go to hear God speak. And the blueprints for the tabernacle in the book of Exodus tell us where to go. In the heart of the tabernacle was the Aron, the ark. Inside the ark were placed the tablets of the Ten Commandments. Above the ark were two cherubim. These were two angel-like forms made out of gold. One of the cherubim had the face of a male child, the other of a female child. And they had wings somewhat like birds. Right? That's kind of the description we get from the Torah. It was from there, above the ark and between those cherubim, that God would speak. So what do we learn from that? God speaks from His Word. God speaks from His mitzvot. God speaks from His Torah. When the sages teach, let everyone be involved in the ark, we learn that not only does each one of us have a share in the Torah that the ark houses, but that each one of us has a share in the ark itself. Since we keep the Torah in our hearts, our heads, our minds, this shows that the ark represents this area of our body. Right? So that's what the ark represents in the tabernacle. It represents our heart. Like when you say, I love God with my heart, or I study the scriptures with all of my heart. Right? That's what the ark represents in your body, in your soul. Above the cover of the ark are the cherubim, the cherubim, two entirely spiritual representations. They have human faces and angel wings. And so we see that they are entirely spiritual since their form is of creatures that do not physically exist. And since we are told that it is from between these two that God speaks to us, this is a metaphor for God and us. Thus, in order to guide us in our approach to God, we are shown the image of two spiritual youths, one male, one female. But don't think gender. Even think mechanical, right? Do you need a male end? Do you need a female end, right? If you got a male end and then they give you a male tool to fix it, guess what? Doesn't connect, right? Got to have the male to go into the female to make the connection. That's what you need to be thinking with male and female in Torah. Remove the gender stuff, right? It's not about gender, okay? It's about connection. One male and one female facing each other with their wings outstretched and touching at the tips. Imagine how these two would speak and listen to each other. And this is how we should speak and listen to God. A still, small voice. But one of the deeper thoughts on this is that the ark cover and those two entities are made out of a single piece of material. So not only the two cherubim, the cherubim, but the ark itself. All one single entity. Okay? They are two only in their form, but of their being, their actual makeup, and their essence, they are one. These two beings speaking to each other are really one, though in this world they appear as two. The infant-like faces of the cherubim signify that our intrinsic bond with God is akin to the essential bond between a parent and a child. Despite any fluctuations that might arise in that relationship, the bond between parent and child can never be broken. The fact that the cherubim were situated above the tablets of the Torah and that they faced each other signified that by studying the Torah, the Word of God, we can reach the root of our soul and allow our consciousness to become one, totally merged with God Himself. The infant faces of the cherubim also alluded to the fact that the Torah, as we know it, is diluted. It is a simplified version of the real heavenly Torah of God's infinite wisdom. God contracted His infinite wisdom into a form that we can understand and digest. Remember Moses' speech problem? He had a vision and he actually saw the real Torah. And he was like, you want me to tell the people what? And so it was at Sinai that all of that dropped down a level and entered into human language. Much as an expert teacher contracts his grasp of a subject in order to convey it to his pupils, right? You go and you take, as a freshman, biology 101. Do you really think that's all that biology professor, that PhD in biology, knows about cells and organisms? No, he's contracting it for you, right? Even if you are a biology major in your senior year and you've made all A's, are you so arrogant as to think you have now learned what your professor knows, who went through 8 more years of education after your level and wrote some original piece of research, right? The professor's always going to be contracting, he's a good professor, always going to be contracting so that his students can grasp up to their level, right? That's how the Torah has been given to us. The fact that the cherubim wings were spread protectively over the ark alludes to the fact that the biblical education of our children also will ensure the preservation and the continuity of the community and the transmission of the Torah tradition. So that's a little bit more of breaking down the chip part of the Aron, the ark and the cherubim. That what's really being described. Now, was there really an ark that had the two cherubim? Yes. Yes, there was. But don't just look at the picture in your study Bible and think that's all it was about. Any more than taking off the cover to your notebook computer and seeing the chip and think, take a picture of that and put that in a study Bible and, you know, and think, oh, I was just supposed to look at that and think it was pretty. You know? No. It's functional. It has a technological function. It is spiritual technology. A dwelling among mortal. All right. Sit back. Enjoy. This is a long one, but it's a good one. A contradiction in terms. So when dedicating the Beit HaMikdash, the very first temple, which the tabernacle foreshadowed and was the prototype of, HaMelech Shlomo, the king known as Solomon, in 1 Kings chapter 8, he exclaims in wonderment this statement. Again, 1 Kings 8. Will God indeed dwell on this earth? The heavens and the celestial heights cannot contain you. How much less this house? Right? Isaiah, heaven and earth are full of your glory. Think about how much more we know of the universe than King Solomon did. He didn't have the Hubble telescope, right? He didn't have radio telescopes beaming out sound beams that keep going and going and going. He didn't know about an expanding universe, right? But he knew that no matter what the universe is, it can't contain all of who God is. And then Solomon is standing in this temple that his father set the groundwork for and says, the universe can't contain you. This house is going to contain you. For the temple was not merely a centralized location for man's worship of God. Again, it was the spiritual technology that brought God to earth so that he could dwell in his people. And so although as the prophet Isaiah declares, the entire earth is full of his glory, God's presence it's not always so tangibly felt. He permeates all existence, but he does so in a hidden way. The tabernacle, and then eventually the temple, by contrast, was, as Deuteronomy 12 states, the place where he chose to call his cause his name to dwell. That's really a good biblical definition of a tabernacle or temple. The place where God chooses to cause his name to dwell. Yeshua carries the name of God, right? So in him is the name of Hashem, dwelt in him. How many times does Yeshua talk about the name of God in the Gospels? So there was no concealment in this place. His presence was openly manifest, right? When you were in the temple, in the tabernacle, in the presence of Yeshua, divinity, the divine was pumping and you knew it. But it's not so right now. So all of this seems impossible. Talking about an infinite God in finite space. How does that work? There's no apparent way that our minds logically can think of infinite spirituality being openly manifest in our finite material world. For material existence to come into being, God has to condense and contract his life and his light energy so that it can become enclosed in material entities. Otherwise, we would blow up, right? Okay? And in the incarnation of our Messiah Yeshua, his divinity becomes enclosed, contracted into flesh and blood. This is absolutely necessary. Were God's light again to be revealed without restraint, it would nullify all matter. To allow for our world to continue in a stable manner, God structures this process of self-containment within laws and principles as binding as those of a governing nature. Nevertheless, although God limited the extent of his revelation when structuring the world, he did not limit himself. He created a world with set bounds, but he's not bound by them, and he can alter them at will. He can invest his presence in our material realm, even in the realm of a human being, just as he did so in the tabernacle, in the temple, and in the temple made flesh in Messiah. The divine presence was revealed in the Holy of Holies, where an ongoing miracle reflected the nature of the revelation in the tabernacle and the temple. And this is where I wanted to see if you paid attention in your reading of the portion. The width of the Holy of Holies is very specific. Anyone remember how many cubits the width of the Holy of Holies is supposed to be? 20 cubits. The Ark of the Covenant, which goes into the Holy of Holies, positioned lengthwise in the chamber, was 2.5 cubits long. So it's 20 cubits wide, and you centered something that was 2.5 cubits wide. And yet, the Torah is emphatic that from one edge to the wall was 10 cubits, and from one edge to the wall was 10 cubits. This is the 12-year-old from 1521 and the 12-year-old from 2016. What is being described here? It's not a contradiction. It's not, oh, look at the stupid editors. They've been copying this Bible for 3,000 years and never caught that mathematical error. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. They would have, if it was an error, someone would have corrected it. They don't have to correct it. It's not an error. What are they trying to describe before the invention of what we know as dimensionality, mathematics, all of that? What's being described here? This is the Torah's way of stating that the physical ark occupied no space. 10 from the edge, that's 20, which means it's not occupying space. Not to mention on Yom Kippur when the priest had to get in there. Right? And not to mention the poles that they got to carry with that poke out. Right? So the Torah, this is a very archaic way, by giving you all these measurements that don't fit, of saying that the ark itself was not in this space and time as we know it. Right? The Holy of Holies was a portal into a different dimension, a different reality, a different place. It was the connecting. If you were doing cinematography, it would be like, you know, opening it up, you know, and sticking your head in there and your head kind of disappearing, you know, and you're looking around and your head's poking out a curtain on the other side. And you're looking into a different universe, right? It's describing that the ark was not in space, okay? In the tabernacle, precise measurement was a necessity. Even a slight deviation from the required dimensions would render an article or building invalid. Just like if you were building a computer, right? What you connect and how you can, all that stuff is detailed. Right? You don't just kind of sloppily put it together. The fact that the place of the ark transcends the limits of space thus represents a fusion of finiteness and infinity. That's also what's being described there. That is the place where the infinite and the finite intersect. Right? This communicates the nature of God's being, that he transcends both finiteness and infinity, and yet manifests himself in both. That God is both transcendent as well as immanent. This is the Torah's intent when speaking of God choosing a place for his name to dwell. The physical limits of our world will not be negated, yet the spiritual will be revealed. And this fusion of opposites will enable us to become conscious of his essence, which transcends and encompasses both the physical and the spiritual. So what we contribute. So God did not want this revelation to be dependent on his influence alone. Right? That's not very loving. It certainly isn't going to be conducive to a relationship. Right? If we're all just robots, if we're all just stormtroopers, if we're all just cloned individuals, like when you take off the stormtrooper mask and we all, 2 million of us, look identical because we were all cloned from one bounty hunter, right? And our whole existence and our whole identity is the stormtrooper. That's not real relationship. You're not going to be in a real relationship with the emperor, okay? So God doesn't want this, as reflected in the verse, and you shall make me a sanctuary, a holy place, a mishkan, a tabernacle, and I will dwell within them. Exodus 25:8. He chose to make the revelation of his presence also dependent on our activity. Since any revelation of God's presence transcends the limit of our existence, the initiative obviously has to come from him. So the initiative is from God. It starts with God. God's the source. This is the whole God alone stuff. Sovereignty of God, not being touched, free will, you can relax, and all that kind of stuff. It's all coming from God. Nevertheless, God does not want his presence to rest upon his people until they understand some of what's resting upon them. They can come to terms with it and want it and desire it and reciprocate. So, until that's why God doesn't just send down a tabernacle from heaven. They have to build the sanctuary, and they have to do so from the donations of their heart, where then his presence could dwell in them. So why were the people's activities so necessary? Because God's intent is that the revelation of his presence be internalized within the world, becoming part of the very fabric of its existence. Were the revelation to come only from above, again, it would nullify our physical world as we know it. To cite a parallel, when God revealed himself on Sinai, the world ground to a standstill. No bird chirped, no ox bellowed, nor did the sea roar. Although godliness was revealed within the world, material existence did not play much of a contributing role. When, by contrast, a dwelling for God is built by man, himself part of the material world, the nature of the materials used is elevated. This becomes even more true in the incarnation, when the materials used for building it are flesh and blood, and thus elevating the human dignity and the sanctity of every human being in every human life, because it is the building tools of the dwelling place of God. This enables God's presence to be revealed within these entities while they continue to exist within their own context. When a revelation of godliness comes from above, it's dependent on God's influence. And therefore, in our world, it's usually temporary. For example, when God descended on Sinai, the mountain became holy. And it says, all that would touch it would die. Remember, don't touch the mountain, it's holy. But when God's presence was withdrawn from the mountain, the people were allowed to touch it and ascend it. The fundamental nature of the mountain had not changed. It was, at its core, just a mountain. With regard to the tabernacle, and then to a greater extent the temple, holiness became a permanent part of their own being. And thus the verse, I will lay waste to your sanctuary, the sages commented, even though they have been devastated, their sanctity remains. Hence the Temple Mount to this day is still holy. Two phases. The above concepts that we've been talking about are highlighted by the name of this week's Torah reading. Now we're going to talk about why it's called Terumah. Because it's unique that it's called Terumah, because usually it's named after one of the first words. But in this particular portion, Terumah is pretty far into the Torah reading. It could have took a different name. All right. So Terumah, one meaning of it is lifting up. The other meaning of it is separation. So a lifting up, but also a separation. This puts the focus on man's attempt to establish a dwelling for God. The Torah proceeds to state that this terumah must involve 13 different articles. As I said earlier, gold, silver, brass, and so forth. This indicates that man's task is to incorporate the various elements of worldly existence into God's dwelling. More particularly, though, that double meaning of the name, lifting up and separation, reflects two factors necessary in creating a dwelling place for God. First, a person must designate his gift, separating it from his otherworldly property. And then through its consecration, its nature becomes elevated above the ordinary material plane. These two phases relate to the two services mentioned in Psalm 34, verse 15. Turn away from evil and do good. When a person prepares a dwelling for a king, he must first clean it. Afterward, he brings in the attractive articles. Similarly, to make our world a dwelling for God, separation is needed. This is where we're about to enter into when we get to Leviticus, all that discussion about holiness and cleanness and so forth. It was really all about separation. Right? Separation is necessary to purge the self-orientation, the ego, encouraged by worldly existence, and only then can it be elevated, lifted up, becoming a medium to draw down God's light. And not an island. The tabernacle and what would become the temple was not intended to be an isolated corner of holiness. Instead, the windows of the temple, we've talked about this, they were designed to spread light outward, right? They didn't have electricity when the temple was built. So they would maximize windows more than we do today. And so usually a building would be structured so that it would catch as much light as possible and project it forward into the room as much as possible. But in the temple, they were built the exact opposite. So that what little light from the menorahs was in the temple would be projected out into the world. The most complete expression of this concept, again, is the idea that from the temple, the tabernacle, it was to be a place that would light the whole world. It would be a light to the nations. The greatest expression of this will be in the era of redemption and when Messiah comes. Isaiah chapter 2, from the mountain of God's house was spread forth the light and the holiness, motivating people to learn God's ways and to walk in his paths. These revelations are dependent on our efforts to encourage the manifestation of the divine presence, where we make our homes and our surroundings sanctuaries in microcosm, or in fractal form, causing God to reveal his presence in this world. In other words, summarizing all of that up, an act below will stir an act above. If you just think you're going to sit here and wait for Messiah to come, you will die waiting. And so will the next generation. And as long as we keep teaching generations that this world is just a horrible place and put it, just deal with it and hopefully Messiah comes before too long, until we start bringing holiness and revealing holiness into this world, we are not creating a dwelling place for God to come and dwell among us in and through his Messiah. Right? So we play a part in it. God didn't build the tabernacle. God didn't build the temple. Okay? The people did. Transcending the intellect. Exodus 26, verse 33. It says, "The curtain will separate for you between the holy and the holy of holies." These two places. The outer chamber of the tabernacle contained three furnishings: the candelabrum, the table of 12 loaves, and the incense altar. The Holy of Holies, in contrast, contained only one furnishing, the Ark of the Covenant. The two chambers of the tabernacle signify the two stages of achieving a messianic divine consciousness and awareness. In the tabernacle's outer chamber, we begin to orient our consciousness towards divinity by focusing our intellect on God. This is why there were three furnishings in the outer chamber. They signify the three components of your intellect: the ability to gain insight, which is known as chokhmah in Hebrew; the ability to comprehend the insight, which is known as bina; and the ability then to make what you've comprehended actually relevant and lived out in your life. That is known as da'at. You take chokhmah, bina, and da'at, and you form an acronym, you get Chabad. Many of you have probably visited Chabad.org. Now you know where Chabad got its name, from Chochma, Bina, and Da'at, the three faculties of your intellect from a Torah perspective. These must first be stimulated and become aware of who God is from an intellectual perspective, through Chochma, then through Bina, then through Da'at. Okay? Once you can arrive at an intellectual consciousness of God through those three gates, you proceed to the next level, the supra-rational consciousness of God. This is the consciousness of the inner chamber, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark is contained within it. At this level, not only our intellect, but our entire being becomes united with the Godhead as one piece, just like the cherubim on top of the Ark. All right, so we will stop there this evening. Hopefully I gave you some things to think about. Again, really try to, each year when we've come to these portions on the tabernacle and then eventually in Leviticus when we start talking about the functions of the priest and the priest's clothing and all of that, really been trying to reorient what's being discussed there. The Torah is not just relating to you history of how this stuff was done. Well, this is just how they built outdoor worship centers back then, right? And stuff like that. Not saying that it doesn't have that component to it. And I'm not saying that some Babylonian group of pagan god worshippers didn't build a similar tabernacle system out in the desert of Iraq, because that was the way they built things back then. I'm not saying or denying any of that stuff. I'm telling you, that's not the important part of it. All right? But they don't have our vocabulary, maps, and metaphors, and we don't have their maps and metaphors. Right? So we're trying to bring it into explaining what really was being conveyed when you unpack it. So when you realize it's so precise in measurements, and then it gives you a piece of furniture that can't fit, well, it knows on a pashat that it can't fit. So what's it trying to convey? All right? Well, with the seven sciences and so forth, we have a map for that. And we know what it's trying to convey. We're now then going to put it in our terminology, right? It's trying to convey dimensionality. Right? Or with the being made of one piece where it looks like two, but in reality is one. Well, we know that is non-duality. Right? And we'll experiment a little bit with the Mobius strip. Okay? Moses didn't have a Mobius. Okay? But we do. So we can then take what he's trying to convey and put it into our map and model. Right? And then we can see the deeper truths. And then we see that this is powerful, powerful spiritual technology that is quite relevant to our own personal development and relationship with God and our understanding of who Messiah is and how we relate to Messiah and what Messiah really was doing when he was here. Right? This will begin to help shape the words Yeshua chose, the actions that he did. Okay? All right, so let's close with the blessing study of Torah. Baruch atah Adonai noten haTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah.